From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
This is that ice cold Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces.
Uptown Funk ruled the airwaves this past year, nominated for 2 Grammys for its big brass sound and retro vibe, top song on iTunes for the year. Its album, Uptown Special, up for another. And Mark Ronson is the man behind it all. He's a big, big player in pop, worked with Amy Winehouse, Adele, Bruno Mars, of course, and many more. A person who himself, a producer who himself, has become a star. This hour on Point, we're talking big time pop music now and how it all works with super producer Mark Ronson. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this your guy? How do you describe his sound, his evolution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is Mark Ronson, Grammy-winning producer, musician, DJ. He's worked with Amy Winehouse, Adele, Paul McCartney, Duran Duran, Bruno Mars, a whole lot more. Won a Grammy for Producer of the Year in 2008. He is up for 3 Grammys this year, 2 for Uptown Funk and 1 for the album it's on, Uptown Special. Mark Ronson in London. Welcome to On Point. So good to have you here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're great, and really happy to sit down with you. I see a headline here from Grantland. They were talking about how all this song came together, and they say how Uptown Funk almost destroyed Mark Ronson before it saved him. We'll talk about the saving part. What was so hard about putting this together? It looks like a big challenge, but you tell us what made it so difficult.
I guess what happens with some songs that basically the song really started out of a jam at Bruno's studio. Bruno was on drums, Jeff Basker, who co-produced the record, he was on keyboards, I was on bass, and sometimes you just get the seed of an idea that's just so exciting to everybody in the room that, you know, just everything seems to catch fire and everyone's just floating on this buzz as you kind of start writing it. But then a lot of the times with songs like that, there's so much promise in the initial seed that whenever you try to get together to finish it, it never has that magic vibe and you just really feel like you're forcing it. So with this song, that really happened. It took about over the course of 7 months and a lot of hair pulling and, you know, creative differences and stuff to really get it to the place where we really always felt like it could go. And, you know, I'm glad every second of work that we put into it, you know, it's kind of all contributed to the end result.
It's just so vast, this giant orchestration of all kinds of inputs there. And I think we all just bathed in it when it finally came out and said, oh my Lord, what a kind of overwhelming thing. Can you take us back and describe that moment where Bruno was, I don't know, was he just singing? Was he on his drums? What was that first inspiration?
Well, basically, we had been messing around with a few ideas. You know, I'd worked with Bruno on his last album, Unorthodox Jukebox, and I just said, hey, man, I'd love to have you on this record. And, he's such an incredible songwriter, performer, producer as well in his own right. And so he said, oh, let's try something out. So he jumped on the drums, I jumped on bass. It was really just kind of like a jam, like a band jamming in a room. And we came up with a kind of initial groove and just started sort of like freestyling lyrics back and forth. And Jeff came up with the lyric, Michelle Pfeiffer, That White Gold. And all of a sudden we're like, oh, wow, that's cool. That sounds like almost like a Kanye line. Like this isn't just like some kind of like, you know, some whatever run-of-the-mill generic pop lyrics, like let's try and make every line like that cool or whatever it is, you know. And I think that, you know, none of us were thinking like massive smash hit song, like, but so much of the music that we love is that late 70s early 80s, like, you know, Black American R&B that's like a mixture of groove, party, house jam, whether it's Prince, The Time, whoever it is. And let's just make a record that just feels cool and that you just want to dance to if it came on the club. And that's where it really started. And then what happened after that was probably a little more labor intensive, but at least it came out of this feeling of kind of like joy in us playing the music that we love the most.
Mark Ronson, I want to ask you, I mean, when it came out, people looked at influences here, and it's just loaded. I mean, it's like a huge delta of rivers flowing into this. But a lot of people pointed, for the beginning of Uptown Funk, they looked back to this German club hit, Din Da Da. This is by George Kranz, 1983. Here's the top of that. Din da da do do do, din da da do do, din da da do do do, din da da do do, din da da do do do, din da da do do, din da da do do do, din da da do do do, din da da do do do. Okay, Din Da Da, 1983. I can hear it. If somebody told me that that was a direct influence to Uptown Funk, I would believe it. But was it a direct influence, or atmospheric, or in your mind at all?
No, it's definitely not something that we really thought about. But I mean, you know, that Din Da Da is a classic record. It's in its own weird way. It's a blueprint. It's part of the blueprint of hip hop. You know, it was one of the early club records that people like Afrika Bambaataa and all these guys and Grandmaster Flash that, you know, kind of set the tone and laid, you know, said these are the classic songs. These are the pillars of hip hop. It is in that canon. And so it wasn't something that we talked about while we were making the record. And of course, a song like Uptown Funk, which is, you know, you could probably play me 20 records and tell me, like, somebody said this sounds right, like right. an influence. And I'd probably go, like, fair enough.
Yeah.
Because there's all this, you know, all this great stuff kind of went into the music that we love. And I spent 20 years DJing in New York nightclubs mm-hmm. playing hip-hop and late 70s funk and these kind of records. But I think what we're always striving to do is make something that feels new and is fresh for today. So you can't help that you love those things and those somehow made it into your DNA and whatnot. But at the end of the day, we're definitely not kind of sitting in a room like, hey, let's take this record and turn it into this, you know?
I'm sure you're not. And yet, as you say, you know the music so well that it can flow whether you're calling directly on it or not. Another sound that was cited here was James Brown, Living in America. And here, Bruno Mars and James Brown, they really got some kind of connection, even if it's just cultural, atmospheric. 1986, Living in America. James Brown, Living in America, 1986. And I know you'll say again, no direct influence. But I guess there's just a library in your head as a DJ.
Yeah, I'm not trying to, like, kind of cry foul or anything. Like, this is just like, you know, of course, there's no way that you should ever even put the word funk anywhere near your song if you're not going to, like, tip your hat to James Brown.
Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, the song is the style of the record, the style, the way we recorded the drums, some of the classic drum machine sounds that are in there were kind of forged in the 80s, these great drum machines like the Lin drum and stuff. And of course, this is James Brown taking the funk that he invented in the mid to late 60s and recording it in the 80s. So I can understand, you know, I can understand kind of all these things. I mean, I love to create music, but also, like, I love the science and understanding it and the tradition and the past and the stuff before me. I mean, when I was 5 years old, I used to memorize liner notes on records and read Billboard magazine. I mean, those aren't like really normal things to probably do when you're five, but I do. I feel like I'm a student of this stuff in the last 40 years of music and the stuff that I love. So I'm happy to sit here and have this conversation with you.
We hear it. We love it. Lots of callers for you. Mark Ronson, super producer, with us from London. Crawford is calling from New Orleans. Crawford, you're on with Mark Ronson.
Hi, Tom and Mark. So glad to be with you guys. Mark, such a big fan. Thank you so much for one of the best grooves of this whole year, if not this whole decade. Man, it's just my wife and I have just been grooving out all year. I can think of many times that we've had it's been the background or the foreground of some of our best times this year. My question for you is your feelings about sort of how ubiquitous singles become nowadays versus, you know, how I guess people used to more appreciate listening to records all the way through versus nowadays, you know, maybe you're even in a Walmart or wherever and you just are hearing singles everywhere. And I'm not complaining about hearing your record everywhere because I still just love it. I can't get enough. But wondering how you feel about how ubiquitous singles have become.
Yeah, it's thank you, by the way, for all those nice things that you said, and I'm glad I've, you know, I do worry with the, you know, the Uptown Funk. It's like it really did become kind of ubiquitous, like you said, to this point where you're like, God, I really hope people don't get so sick of it that they start, you know, throwing things at me in the street as I'm walking by. And you know how that can happen with a song sometimes, like a song you can love it for the first 2, 3, 4 months it's out, and then, you know, it can be played and played and played.
But is that new? I mean, singles have been spun again and again and again for certainly your 40 years and more.
I think it's, you know what it is? The music really started off, or at least when pop music really exploded in the whole teenager culture in the 50s and 60s, it really was a singles game. And that's really what it was about. And, you know, up to then, jazz had been about the album and about artistry and this thing. And then when bands like the Beatles and Sly and the Family Stone and people started to come that really had that weight and could make a whole album that you'd want to listen to, then it kind of switched, and the 70s and 80s became about albums again. And I guess what we're seeing now with, you know, Spotify and iTunes and streaming is we're going back to the singles culture. But, you know, I still believe that the album is the last kind of art form or thing that we have in music. So I still, you know, it's still really important to me to make a great whole album. But if somebody just loves Uptown Funk and that's all that they want to listen to, then that's kind of fine with me as well.
Behind us right here, Uptown's first finale featuring Stevie Wonder. This is off the full album, Uptown Special, where you'll find Uptown Funk. Super producer, DJ, musician Mark Ronson is with us. You can join us this hour, 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Did you get down with Uptown Funk? 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with DJ, producer, musician, Uptown Funk master, Mark Ronson, nominated for 3 Grammys this year for his work with Bruno Mars and more on Uptown Funk, Uptown Special. Looking at his sound, his take on music, old and new, his work with Amy Winehouse, Adele, Ghostface Killa, and many more. Everybody Got Their Something by Nikki Costa behind us right here from 2001. This is the moment when Mark Ronson made his leap from DJ to producer, producer of this song. He joins us today from London. He's been up, he's been down, up very big with Amy Winehouse and Adele. He is way up again now. Big Grammy nominations. You can join us. Did you get down with Uptown Funk last year? Did you find yourself wondering who put all that together? And have you followed the producing career of Mark Ronson? How do you hear his sound? The veins he mines. We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Mark, stand by in London. Lots of callers for you. Ypsilanti, Michigan. Vicky, you're on the air with Mark.
Oh, my gosh. Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
What's up? What do you know?
I am just... Oh, that song. I'm a teacher. I'm a parent of 4 children from age 5 to 18. And I was on a field trip the first time I ever heard that song. And
Uptown Funk, yeah.
The kids screamed, "Turn it up!" And I'm hearing them singing it, and I'm going, "Oh my God, turn this up! This is my music. What are you talking about?" I just think it really bridges an intergenerational. It's just got the intergenerational bridge that you need to have such a success with a song. What a great song! It lets me escape in my day. If I hear it, I'm not a teacher. I'm not a parent. I'm not a wife. I am on the dance floor, even if I'm in my car.
We love it.
It brings me out of the real world for 2.5 minutes, you know?
Hey, we love it, Vicky. You and a whole lot of other people. That is very obvious from the popularity of this song, and I'm so glad you shared that with us. Hey, Mark, hang, stand by. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to you. Becky in Boca Raton, Florida. Becky, you're on the air.
Mark, I am so honored. I am just, you have no idea. You are just such a phenomenal talent. I'm 64 years old, and I have to tell you, for my generation, who grew up with Motown, who grew up with the Beatles, you are sort of like this beam of light now that has come out, and I know you've been out there for quite a long time, and I just had to reach out to you and say thank you so much, because we still feel young bopping away to your songs, and you and I know that this song that you did with Bruno is not the only song you've done. You've done quite a few others. You are an amazingly talented young man. Don't ever stop. Keep it up. You certainly keep my generation going. And my question to you is this. What has inspired you? And I guess one other one, when did you know you had this phenomenal talent? God bless you. Keep doing it. And I will listen off air. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Becky.
Thank
Mark,
you.
That is all over to you, Mark. What do you say?
Well, if I knew that this interview is going to be one of the happiest days of my life. Thank you. It's really lovely to hear these sentiments from everybody. And I guess the first question was about what inspires me. And it's probably every, you know, genre of music and stuff that I've loved. I mean, you discover them all at different times, not necessarily maybe like chronologically. Like I discovered Stevie Wonder when I was kind of in my late teens and listened to funk and bands like The Meters and James Brown when I was 13, and listened to a lot of like classic hip hop from that era, like Tribe Called Quest and things like that. But I kind of get inspired by everything. And then, of course, so much inspiration comes from the amazingly talented people that I've got to work with. So people like Amy Winehouse or Bruno Mars or Jeff Basker, like those are the you get inspired being in a room with those people, the kind of ideas that generate when you're just kind of, you know, throwing things back and forth or just kind of jamming with an instrument in your hand.
I've got a comment here from Danielle. This is on Facebook. And she says, no question from me, but I'd love to thank Mark for all those Wednesday nights he DJed at the Bar Dance Club at Vassar my senior year. The music he played was the soundtrack to some great memories. I mean, we can hear that you've got London in your background, but you've got the U.S. as well. Was that college for you, or what was going on?
Yeah, so my mom moved to New York when I was 8, and I grew up and went to high school on the Upper West Side in New York, and then I went to Vassar College for about a year. And yeah, I used to DJ at the Mug. And I learned a lot about soul and funk records there from a couple DJs, DJ named Ben Velez and another fellow named Nikosi. And those were the guys that taught me a lot about, you know, the more like rare stuff like Roy Ayers and, you know, not just Earth, Wind & Fire, Michael Jackson, but people like, you know, like Roy Ayers and that kind of stuff. And I cut my teeth and learned a lot DJing in that you know, school bar. Like, I mean, like everybody learned somewhere, you know.
We've got a little bit more from Uptown Special, the album with Uptown Funk on it. This is Daffodils. This features the indie artist Kevin Parker. Keep in mind as you listen here, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon wrote the majority of the lyrics on this album, not Uptown Funk itself, but co-wrote the lyrics to this song with Tame Impala's Kevin Parker. Here's Daffodils featuring Kevin Parker from 2015's Uptown Special. Daffodils with Kevin Parker there from Uptown Special. I've got to ask you, I mean, this is a very infectious album. But for me, at this point, I'm listening to this song. It's just a big way back machine. Grantland calls you a retro futurist. This one seems mainly back there to me. Or is it just that my ears become acculturated to a contemporary sound as well, and I mash them all together? Is this old or new or both?
I mean, I think probably what it is that, you know, I have a lot of the sounds that I love and the textures of the drums and these kind of instruments and the performances really are something that was probably the most forged in the 60s and 70s, the way you record drums to tape, the way musicians play that stuff. Obviously, it's a bit of a dying art form because most music is made and programmed and quantized in computers and drum machines now. So, of course, you hear a great live drummer played in a beautiful recording, it's just going to instantly make you think like, oh, that's what they did in the 70s. And I don't think it's necessarily because I'm trying to recreate anything that happened then. It's just like, those are the sounds that I love. Those are the sounds like when I've got one hand on a dial of an EQ and we're trying to get a great drum sound, like that's what I'm searching for, you know? But then there's, of course, there's other things and, you know, synthesizers and other elements and weird noises and things going on that are from today. So yeah, I guess, listen, I'm not going to lie and say that, like, no way, I never listened to old music and this is just my own version of the future. That's ridiculous. I mean, I love the sound and the warmth of analog recordings. But of, like I said before, you know, always trying to, you know, put our stamp on it and make it for now.
And you do. And he does. Jeremy in Detroit. You're on with Mark Ronson. Thanks for calling, Jeremy.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
How's it going, Mark?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. My question today for you is, you know, you have such a way of bringing heart and personality and soul to a mass audience. And I'm just wondering, when you're laying down a track or recording an album, how do you know if you've been overproduced? And do you ever sort of sit there and think, you know, maybe we should take one, two steps back. Maybe we had something, we overthought it.
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah, that is a really valid question. It's something that comes up all the time. You know, you've got something and you can maybe tinker around with it too much, or you start to add a few too many layers. And, you know, there's great stories that Rick Rubin, like when he was working with Kanye on his albums and a couple people, the first thing that he came in and did was just literally strip everything back about 17 layers. And, you know, Rick Rubin is a example of a great producer that you always feel the artist, whether it's Johnny Cash or whoever, really come out of it. And I think that's the thing, like, you've got to, as a producer, you're sometimes tempted to put these bells and whistles and things on it, but you always have to remember, like, is this thing going to make the listener connect with the artist? Is, like, is that song that you know, that emotion and intent that they had, is that what's coming through the most? So it's just a bit of a, you know, sometimes it's a taste and a judgment thing, because someone else who might think that, you know, that's not too many layers might pile on a couple more things. But you're just sort of a little bit going with your gut, and you're doing with whatever it is that you think is really going to kind of make that song, I guess, just be as, I guess, connect as much as possible.
How do you think about the role of the producer these days? I mean, producers have been big for a long time, Phil Spector and all that, Rick Rubin, of course, you mentioned. But now, pop music can seem so complex and layered that the producer seems sometimes as or more important than the performers. You are sometimes both with your guitar, even on rare occasions singing. But how do you think of the role of the producer today? Are you the generator of this? In the past, we thought of producers as taking talent and, you know, sort of buffing it up. Today, it seems like it's something else. What is it?
I think, like, when I think about it, if you go back to the early 2000s when pop music started to get a bit more kind of like, you know, singles-oriented, and suddenly you had these producers like Pharrell and the Neptunes and Timbaland, whose work was almost, not almost, his work was definitely more consistent than some of the artists that they were producing. So, okay, so you see that the Neptunes produced a song for Ray J, who you might never have heard of before, but all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, the Neptunes did it. I like everything they do, so I'm going to check it out. So suddenly, you know, you have people, like I said, Pharrell, Timbaland, who become these sort of names that you can trust because you like their stuff, you like their previous work, and then they start to, I guess, yeah, they start to get a little bit bigger, you know, even than some of the artists that they're working with. But
is that because of technology, Mark? Because you can do so much without ever lifting an instrument these days? Does that make the producer a bigger deal in the musical, you know, cosmos?
I don't know if it. I think it's just because what they actually do is kind of good. I mean, Pharrell is obviously like a super talented piano player.
Yeah.
You know, musician, plays all the drum beats. I don't. It's hard to say, like, exactly what it is. I mean, I'm sure, like, John Seabrook's book that he wrote about, that has got a really, John Seabrook is a great, you know,
the song machine. We had him on not long ago talking about all the Scandinavian producers who are laying down the backdrop to so much these days, framing it all up.
Yeah, he does a kind of good job, way better than I can right now with my, like, sort of, like, verbal constipation or whatever's going on in England right now. I apologize, because people are asking really great questions. I'm trying to, like, to get it out. But I think that basically, you know, it became that the producer's output was more reliable and kind of stronger than some of the artists that they were working with, and that's what it is.
Nigel, Virginia Beach, Virginia, you're on with Mark Ronson.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Okay.
I'm a producer myself. I've been recording songs for the last 35 years, mostly a bunch of Motown, disco, 70s funk kind of tunes. And I deconstructed Uptown Funk and did a recording of it that with a band called the Right On Band. They call it Right On Funk. And I'd love to be able to send you a copy, see what you think, because I think I did a really great job. But my question to you is, when I was reconstructing the song, there was so much minute detail that I found, not just simple things like the hi-hat pattern or the bass line, but things like that in the pre-chorus, that little eerie kind of pad that you put in to kind of build attention before the chorus drops, and even all the subtle little things that you did to that song. I never spent so much time recreating a song as I did with this one because of all the little nuances that were in there that most people are not going to realize, you know? And my question to you is, I took a bunch of different horn sections in there and I never was happy with any one of them. And I've done a ton of Motown songs, a ton of funk tunes with horn sections, and I'm really good at recording horns. I couldn't get the horns to sound like you got them to sound. I had to take a bunch of different horn sections and blend the tell me what you did.
Yeah.
I couldn't get the horns to sound as good as your horns.
Producer to producer, what's the secret sauce? I know it wasn't easy. You've said your hair was falling out with the anxiety of it, Mark Ronson, but how about it?
Well, yeah, well, like, you know, that's right. The one thing about spending a lot of time on this song, you know, even the things like the little nuances in the recordings that came out, you know, it was in the very last recording session in Toronto working with Bruno where we came up with the part like, that happens at the end. And just all those little things just kept coming. The horns, I mean, that's really just because those guys, Dave Guy and Neil and Michael Lionheart and Ray, that, you know, the guys who played on Dap Kings and Sharon Jones and played on Amy Winehouse, they're just such incredible horn players. But, you know, that the song Uptown Funk, the style of the playing is a little bit more of like a Earth, Wind & Fire 80s, like less sort of like 60s soul. But those guys are just such great players. They can kind of play anything. So, yeah, we messed around a lot of ribbon mics and tried maybe one mic with everybody. But I think what we ended up doing was putting, you know, four ribbon mics. It was two trumpets, trombone, and a tenor sax, and just those great players. And Bruno came up with a great line, and that's kind of, I guess, the brunt of it.
Julio, get the stretch. Don't believe me. Just watch. How much of this was synthesized music, and how much was live instrument or you know, real instruments?
Everything's pretty much, you know, the bass, drums, horns, guitar, that's all live. There's a little bit of synths, like, you know, the kind of, actually, there's a lot of synths, and that's all Jeff Basker, but that's all being played live, and, you know, none of it's
co-producer.
Even sort of MIDI'd or quantized. And yeah, and so it's really all, to be honest, it's about 90% live, I would say, and then there's a few little, like, kind of sound effects and things like that that we added to, you know, to make it feel like now.
You dip a lot into the past and do other work to realize your own. What do you think when people, I mean, there's Nigel, a producer, trying to reproduce your Uptown Funk, and you can go online and find all kinds of takeoffs on it and people going every which direction. How do you feel when people sample your work or try and recreate it?
I think that's one of the greatest, you know, I guess, not compliments in a way, but it's just like a nice nod. I mean, I can't tell you how many songs I've sat home, whether it's Stevie Wonder, Steely Dan, whoever it is, trying to figure out how they played that piano riff or just learning it. And that's a great part. And I think that somebody told me some staggering number, like there's 1.2 million individual covers of Uptown Funk on YouTube.
And incredible.
It's just like, I don't know, I think it's the coolest thing. I really am. Like, every time I hear one of them, it doesn't matter whether it's on a kazoo or ukulele or some guy playing slap bass in his room. It's so cool.
Super producer Mark Ronson is with us. He's up for 3 Grammys for his work this year, Uptown Funk, Uptown Special. Joins us from London today. He's worked with a lot of great artists. We'll talk about that. Amy Winehouse, Adele behind us here, worked with her on Cold Shoulder, a single from her debut album 19 back in 2008. Last year, worked with her again on her album 25, a bonus track on the special Target album release. This is Adele with Lay Me Down, produced by my guest, Mark Ronson. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mark Ronson in London, please stand by. Great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with super producer, DJ, musician Mark Ronson. Up for 3 Grammys this year for Uptown Funk, Uptown Special, the album that came out on with Bruno Mars. Worked with Bruno Mars back on this Locked Out of Heaven 2012 song on Mars' Unorthodox Jukebox album. Mark Ronson joins us today from London. You can join us. What's your question for him on working with Amy Winehouse, Adele, Bruno Mars? And is Mark Ronson giving you what you want in pop music? Is he taking us forward? Taking us back? Does it matter? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. What fun to be able to put the questions right to the man making so much huge music these days. Devin in Washington, D.C. Devin, you're on with Mark Ronson in London. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I live in D.C. where, of course, there is a lot of live bands, percussion, bass, it's called go-go music.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, do you plan on working with that type of genre? Do you see yourself sticking with musicians as opposed to studio?
When I started working with, I used to have a label through Interscope, and one of the first artists that I worked with was this rapper from D.C. named Wale. And Wale introduced me to a lot of great go-go musicians from the D.C. area and took me to a go-go. And I also, you know, from the early days when I started DJing, you would always play things like Busting Loose by Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers and bands like Junkyard. So, you know, I love the style of playing and the percussion of that comes from go-go music. So I definitely something that I'd probably end up. So thank you for reminding me. Like, it's something that I definitely would love to get more into the music that I I've been working on.
I want to talk about your experience working with Adele and especially with Amy Winehouse. A lot of people thinking again about Amy lately with the big documentary Amy that's come out. But we just heard a little bit of Adele, and of course she's huge right now with the new album 25. We've got Cold Shoulder here. This is from 19, the debut album. You produced the single Cold Shoulder. Let's listen for just a minute.
You say it's all in my head, and the things I think just don't make sense. So where you been then? Don't go all coy. Don't turn it around on me like it's my fault. See, I can see that look in your eyes. Shoots at me each and every time. You break me with your cold shoulder. Whenever you look at me, I wish I was her.
Cold Shoulder, sung by Adele, produced by my guest Mark Ronson. How did that meeting happen, Mark? And what was your role? Describe how you interacted with Adele around this song, if you would.
Well, I went into the label XL, which is the recording, you know, the English record company that Adele was signed to. And I went in and I went into the Richard Russell, who's the head of XL's office. And there was this like kind of cool 19-year-old girl chain smoking Marlboro Lights and watching Jerry Springer on the TV. And it was Adele. And I said, you know, yeah, nice to meet you, whatever. She was like, yeah, I got this song I want you to produce. And so she played me the demo of Cold Shoulder. And it was just her on the Wurlitzer electric piano. And it was definitely like, you know, it was jaw-dropping. You could already hear the voice in the song. And that was kind of it. And, you know, at the time, I just had the Amy Winehouse out. I was feeling a bit like the hotshot producer. And I was kind of like, oh, well, do you have anything else you sort of want to play me? Or maybe there's another song. And she just looked me dead in the eye. And she's like, no, you can take this one or nothing. And so that was kind of it. And she's already like, you know, she knows her own. She's so aware of her own talent and power and how her music needs to sound. Even when we were working on Lay Me Down from this new record, like there's not a lot of artists that really have that much talent and also really know exactly how it's supposed to be wielded and sounded. And she's pretty amazing like that.
So if we force you to tell us exactly what your role is within that, within her or
okay,
around her
so
artistry,
basically,
what is
all right,
it?
So if we take this song, so this song was just a demo of her and an electric piano. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I did was, you come up with the band arrangement. So you decide, okay, what's the drums? What's the tempo? What are we playing? Come up with the guitar parts. Help the bass player, Stuart Zender, who's an amazing bass player, play this great bass line. helping with the string arrangements with Chris Elliott, and then recording the vocal, recording everybody. I guess you're, you know, you're putting up all the mics on the instruments and determining how it's going to sound. And so it's really different with each artist that you ever work with, what the role as a producer really does. But that's a very basic, probably, you know, that's probably a thing that applies to most songs that I work on. You kind of get a raw song and then you're deciding and helping them flesh out the arrangement.
And how much are you, what's the word, schooling Adele there on, do it a little more this way, a little more that way, or do you give her her own head there, her own lead?
I mean, she's just one of those people that you just hit record and she's just incredible. You really don't need to, like, her, Amy, Bruno, some of those singers, like, they know their own voice. And even when we were doing Lay Me Down off Adele's new record, you know, I think we must have been on, like, take number 23 of her singing the song mm-hmm. all the way down. And I mean, her voice and the vocals, it's everything sounded incredible from take three. And but she just knew that, like, if I keep going, that's when I break into that part of my voice where, like, the gravel comes out and the grit. And to be that good and still have the commitment to just, like, keep going take after take and kind of, like, really, like, wearing your voice out just because you know that's when you get to that magic spot. You know, that's kind of, like, I don't know if it's what you call dedication, but it's just, like, it's so... It just makes everything so much greater in the final song that comes out.
A good producer goes there with you, with the artist. Sam in Jefferson City, Missouri. Sam, you're on the air with Mark Ronson. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. I guess I have kind of a comment, sort of a question. With the current music, so much of it seems to be trending towards the dance music versus vocals. And God bless Adele and you for managing her well, that she gets to sing and show off her voice. But people like Mary Kay Blige, who have fantastic voices and just beautiful stuff that, you know, I kind of wish that they'd sing the old standards so that you could hear the melody of their voice and everything. Is that just something that the times don't really want to hear? Or is that something that maybe I need to be listening to different people?
I think with somebody like Mary J. Blige, who has one of the greatest voices of the past 40 years, I think, you know, on the record, there's always a few up-tempo songs because that's still that's still how labels think. Okay, well, we need an up-tempo one for the dance or whatever. And then you have these, like, you know, gorgeous ballads. And Mary's really amazing in the way that she has these songs like No More Drama and some things that manage to keep, like, the tempo and the driving beat, but you really just hear all the passion and the soul in her voice. And then you have people like Lady Gaga, who has a phenomenal voice, and when she's just sitting at the piano and just singing, you know, she could have hung with anyone in any era or generation. Then she goes and does a standards record with Tony Bennett, maybe to channel, you know, maybe a side of that, like you said, doing the standards that you might not get to do in pop world. But I mean, the absolute best thing to me is when you can kind of manage to nail both of them, I guess, at the same time. I mean, you're never going to be able to do it all the time, but if you can really let a singer's performance and their soul and passion come through in a way that it just, like, hits you in the gut, but you can still have, like, a band playing behind it, you know, that's when you get the kind of really, you know, special thing. For me, because I love rhythm arrangements and that sort of thing.
Let's listen to one with whom, a great, with whom you certainly did that, no longer with us, sadly, but Amy Winehouse. You produced most of her Grammy-winning Back to Black album. You dedicated Uptown Special, last year's big album, to her. She was a featured artist on your 2007 album Version for the song Valerie. Since I come home, well, my body's been a mess, and I miss your ginger hair and the way you like to dress. I want you to come on over and stop making a fool out of me. Why don't you come on over, Valerie? The great Amy Winehouse with Valerie there off of Mark Ronson's 2007 album Version. Mike in Burlington, Vermont, you're on with Mike Ronson and Amy Winehouse right behind us.
Hello, fellas.
Hi.
Hey.
My question goes about Back to Black, an album which I think is the best album of its decade, and such a singular talent Amy Winehouse was. If you could reflect a little bit on what it was like working with a talent like that, and also in your music going forward, have you ever considered working with another singular talent, the guitar player Buckethead?
With Amy, some of it, I didn't even realize how great it was at the time when we were working on it. Like, even lyrics like Back to Black, sometimes I hear them back. Or, you know, that was one of the really beautiful things about the documentary Amy by Asif Kapadia, is that you see the lyrics on screen. And that really kind of hit me. And I guess the thing with Amy was, you know, we made the record so quickly. It was like literally maybe 6 days of fleshing out the arrangements. Then she went back to England, and then I went to Brooklyn and cut the rhythm tracks with the Dap Kings. So I kind of wish it took longer, because I'd have more memories or just like more, you know, time in the studio with her. But it just, we just hit a rhythm, and we hit it off musically and kind of personally. And it just, we kind of hit the ground running. And I guess working with her was just, like I said, you just kind of hit record. And with a lot of singers, you might record 10 or 12 takes and then comp the best parts of each verse together. With her, you would just maybe record 3 times, and they were all so amazing. Because she was kind of a jazz singer, she would change it each time, mm-hmm. just because she got bored singing the same thing. She was like an improvisationalist in some ways. And then you just kind of like, you kind of, you know, have to pick one and be like, crap. Like, you know, I'd be like, it was such a hard thing to pick takes. I'd be like, wow, if I pick this one instead of that one, then I'm robbing the whole world ever of hearing this performance. But you just kind of follow your gut and just sometimes eeny, meeny, miny, moe it. And that's kind of, you know, honestly, all those vocals were brilliant that she recorded.
I just saw the documentary, Amy. It's so great. Her pathos is laid out there so clearly. Ultimately, the drugs and eating disorders and everything else that led to her tragic, too early death. But in the part where she's recording with you, everything looks so carefree. It made me wonder how you interact with an artist like that away from the studio, or if you even do. I mean, you look young and like, hey, everything's just carefree and fine. Did you know of the kind of struggles she was having away from the work you were doing with her?
Well, she was completely together, and she was pretty much sober when we were working. So there weren't any, you know, troubles. And obviously, being a good friend, you know, I saw it for a bit from the outside as, you know, things got a little bit worse. But no, when she came into the studio, I had heard these stories. And like, if you've seen the movie, you know, she was a bit, you know, she was messed up before she came in. And everyone's like, oh, you're working with Amy Winehouse. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what is everyone talking about? Like, this girl's brilliant. She's an incredible talent and a pure, like, joy and the funniest, most charismatic singer I've ever been around. So, you know, that I just managed to catch her at this moment where everything was kind of, like, really great in her life, and she was just together.
Peter in Boston. Peter, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you very much. I'll make this brief, and I'll hang up and listen. So I feel that musically, specifically hip-hop, for example, has seen the trend from the 80s to the current, from what would be groups, bands, to solo acts. I think that's also rock and roll's maybe kind of stayed its course with groups staying intact. I just wondered if there was any insight to if my perception is correct. If so, why has that become where we're looking at?
The solo act, sort of a dominating...
Yeah. That's so great. It's a really great question. It's something I kind of like just thought about recently, because if you think about hip-hop and the classic groups, whether it's N.W.A., Wu-Tang, Tribe Called Quest, EPMD, Gangstar, they're these great groups, and they kind of were usually made up of like one producer and then a few vocalists. And it's really not. And I don't know if it has to do with the fact that like... you have a lot of people just like alone in their bedroom. It's sort of like the, you know, the new era of the internet age of you have less bands. You have people kind of just like making their own music on a laptop and then kind of lending their vocals to it or what it is. But I definitely missed the era of the group, because it really did provide for some really exciting music, because you'd have these contrasting voices and you know, and you just have more than just one voice on a record, which was great. So I'd love to see some of the group stuff come back for sure.
Where are you headed next? You've had a big run with funk and different flavors of it. I don't know how it works for somebody in your business. Do you put your ears way out front? You're looking for that next inspiration? Do you have a sense of what direction the next Mark Ronson push will be in?
Well, I think a lot of it comes from, I mean, my first instrument was the drums. My first love was sort of funk and R&B music and the stuff that, you know, my dad played growing up. So it's always going to be kind of rhythm based in that. But, you know, you get pulled and inspired in different directions from the people that you collaborate with. So, you know, for me, I'm always excited for the next person, whether it's somebody who's just like literally about to make their first record or somebody more known. But that's where all that's going to, I guess that's where I'm going to kind of find it.
Mark Ronson, it's been just great spending a little time with you there in London. You're generous to do it. You can hear people enjoying it around the country here in the States. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mark Ronson. He's nominated for 3 Grammys this year for Uptown Funk, Uptown Special, the album that was on. We go out with one more from that Grammy-nominated album. Here's In Case of Fire, featuring Jeff Basker, Ronson's co-producer on the album. Ronson's on guitar. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.